A moment later, a second, more powerful explosion rocked the area. Darsha felt the stairwell shift and shudder, as if in the throes of a trembler. The light went out. She felt herself falling, and then she knew no more. Newt Gunray was in his suite on board the Sakak, trying to enjoy a mildew rubdown and failing utterly, when his private comlink chimed. His masseuse had slathered his naked form with liquefied green mold and was industriously kneading the muscle nodules of his upper back, which were so tight with tension that he could hear them crackle. At his grunted acknowledgement, the image of Rune Hakko formed near the massage table. The barrister did not look happy, but that in itself meant little. Nemoidians as a species rarely looked happy.
"I have news,"
Hakko said in a low voice.
"Come to my quarters,"
Gunray replied, and the hollow image flickered out. Whatever news Hakko had for him was best heard in person, in the privacy of his sanctum. He dismissed the masseuse, donned a vermilion robe, and paced restlessly, awaiting Hakko's arrival. The intricacies of protocol dictated that he be sitting at ease in a couch or chair, his nonchalant attitude conveying the impression that no matter what news Hakko might be bearing, it could not possibly be important enough to cause him any concern. The door panel slid open, and Hakko entered. A moment later, Dalti Dauphine entered as well. Gunray steeled himself. One look at his compatriot's hunched postures and furtive means assured him that he was not about to hear good news.
"I have just heard from the consular representative at our embassy on Coruscant,"
Hakko said. His willingness to skip the preamble of verbal fencing and get right to the subject was ample evidence that his concern was just as great as Gunray's.
"One of our people has been killed there."
Gunray had to will his salivary glands to moisten his palate before he was able to speak.
"Was it Monchar?" "At this point, we don't know for certain,"
Dauphine said.
"There was evidently an explosion, although the investigation is unclear as to whether that was the cause of death. Genetic ID verification is pending."
"However,"
Hakko continued, lowering his voice and peering about as if he expected Darth Sidious to appear at any moment,
"a piece of singed cloth that was once part of a mitre of the office of Deputy Viceroy was found at the scene."
Newt Gunray closed his eyes and tried to imagine what life as a mulch farmer back on Nemoidia would be like.
"In addition,"
Dauphine said,
"several other bodies were discovered at the scene of the explosion. One of them has been conclusively identified. The bounty hunter, Mawi Lin."
Mulch farming probably had its good points, Gunray told himself. For one thing, the possibility of having to deal with the Sith in his new occupation was very unlikely.
"I think we must admit the conclusion that Hath Monchar is no longer among the living,"
Rune Hakko said.
"This is a disaster,"
Dauphine whined.
"What will we tell Lord Sidious?"
What indeed? The Viceroy of the Federation wondered. Oh, there was no shortage of lies that they could come up with, but would Sidious believe any of them? That was the all-important question. And the answer, much as Gunray hated to admit it, was almost certainly not. Only one thing was certain. Soon, very soon, they would have to tell the Sith Lord something. Jedi Master Yoda entered the conference antechamber, a smaller room off to one side of the council chamber. Mace Windu and Qui-Gon Jinn were already seated at the pleakwood table. Behind them, a floor-to-ceiling transparisteel window offered a panoramic view of the endless architectural welter that was Coruscant and its continuous streams of air traffic. Yoda moved slowly toward one of the chairs. He leaned on his gimmistick cane as he walked, and Windu had to suppress a smile as he watched Yoda's progress. While Yoda was easily the oldest member of the Council, being well over 800 standard years of age, he was by no means as decrepit as he sometimes pretended to be. Windu waited until his colleague was seated before he spoke. "I have not deemed it necessary to call a general meeting of the Council concerning this yet. Nevertheless, it is a problem that, in my opinion, warrants discussion." Yoda nodded.
"Of the Black Sun matter you speak?"
"Yes. Specifically of Ulf the Fundarian, and the Padawan Darsha Asant who was sent to bring him here." "Has there been any word at all from her?" Qui-Gon Jinn asked. "None. It has been almost 48 hours. The mission should not have taken more than 4 or 5 at the most."
"Anun Bondara is missing as well,"
Yoda said reflectively.
"Coincidence? I doubt it is."
"You think Bondara has gone in search of Asant?" Windu asked. Yoda nodded.
"Understandable," Jin said. "Asant is his Padawan. If he felt she was in danger, he would look into it."
"Of course he would," Windu replied. "But why did he not inform any of us as to his intentions, and why has there been no communication from either of them?" There was silence for a moment as the three Jedi Masters pondered the questions. Then Yoda said,
"Some infraction on her part, perhaps he knew or suspected. Want to protect her from repercussions, he would."
"However noble Anun Bondara's intentions," Windu said, "we cannot have him and Asant acting without the knowledge or consent of the Council."
"Agreed we are on this matter," Yoda said. "Send an investigator, we must."
"Yes," Windu said. "But who? With the current state of affairs in the Republic Senate, all our senior members are on standby alert, and may continue to be for some time."
"I have a suggestion," Qui-Gon Jinn said. "Dispatch my Padawan. If Black Sun is involved, he will be able to sense it."
"Obi-Wan Kenobi? Potentially strong in the Force, he is,"
Yoda mused.
"A good choice he would be."
Mace Windu nodded slowly. Yoda was right. Though not yet a full-fledged Jedi Knight, Kenobi had amply demonstrated his skills in battle and in negotiation. If anyone could find out what had happened to Bondara and Asant, he could. The senior member of the Council stood.
"We are decided, then. Qui-Gon, you will explain the situation to Kenobi, and send him on his way as soon as possible. There is something about all this."
Windu was silent for a moment.
"Yes,"
Yoda said soberly.
"No accident, this was."
Qui-Gon Jinn said nothing. He merely nodded his agreement, then stood.
"Obi-Wan will leave for the Crimson Corridor immediately," he told Windu and Yoda.
"May the Force be with him,"
Yoda said softly. There is no emotion, there is peace. There is no ignorance, there is knowledge. There is no passion, there is serenity. There is no death, there is the Force.
The Jedi Code was one of the first things Darsha Asant had learned in the Jedi Temple. As a child, she would sit cross-legged on the cold floor for hours at a time, repeating the words over and over, meditating on their meaning, letting that meaning seep into her bones. There is no emotion, there is peace. There is no ignorance, there is knowledge. There is no passion, there is serenity. Master Bondara had taught her so many things, had helped her forge her life into something far beyond anything she had thought it was her potential and destiny to be. She owed him so much, and now she would never be able to repay him. There is no death, there is the Force. Darsha knew that if she had truly internalized the first three maxims of the Jedi Code, she would be able to take comfort from this last one as well. But it was obvious that she had not reached that stage yet. because she could find no peace, no serenity, in the knowledge that her mentor was dead. All she could do was grieve. She had been in a state of half-awareness, her only real emotion that of sorrow, for an unknown amount of time, before she was jolted back to consciousness by a building vibration and roar that seemed to be hurtling toward her. She opened her eyes in time to see a huge transport vehicle thunder by, only a meter or so from where she lay. The sound of it passing was deafening. Then it was gone, the roar dopplering swiftly away to silence. She looked around, saw Lorne Pavan seated against a wall about a meter away, and I-5 standing next to him. She realized where they were, in one of the countless service conduits that stitched Coruscant's lowest levels. Through these tunnels flowed an endless automated stream of vehicles hauling goods and materials from spaceports and factories to millions of destinations all over the planet-wide metropolis. "How did we get down here?" she asked. Even as the question left her lips, she dimly recalled being dragged from the wreckage of the sky car and down the stairwell by the droid as the craft's power cell exploded. He had undoubtedly saved both of their lives. Pavan jerked a thumb at I-5. "Thank Wonder Droid here. Hadn't been for him, we'd both be hash for the armored rats. Sometimes he's almost worth having around."
"Please, don't gush," the droid said. "It's embarrassing."
Dasha struggled to her feet. She checked for her lightsaber and was relieved to find it hanging where it should be from her utility belt.
"Where's the stairwell?" she asked. "I have to see if..."
"If Master Bandara is still alive," she finished to herself. She could not bring herself to say it out loud for fear that one of them might tell her what she already knew. Pavan pointed to an alcove about 2 meters away. "But the stairwell won't do you any good. The Skycar's explosion brought about a ton of real estate down on it. We'll have to find another way out." Dasha nodded.
"Then we'd better get going. There has to be another access stairwell along this route."
"Why not just call for help?" Pavan asked. "You've got a comlink, haven't you?"
"I had one, but it was damaged earlier."
It occurred to her only now that she should have replaced it when she had been back at the temple. Pavan raised an eyebrow. "First time I've seen a Jedi who wasn't prepared for everything." There was a faint note of sarcasm in his voice. Dasha bit back the retort that rose to her lips. It wouldn't take much to put him on her list of least favorite people. After all, he was indirectly responsible for Master Bandara's death. On the other hand, he had saved her from falling out of the sky car. "Don't you have a comlink?" she asked. Pavan looked uncomfortable and didn't reply.
"Yes, he does,"
I-5 said.
"It's in fine working order, too, except that the power pack is depleted and he can't afford to replace it."
Dasha said nothing to that. Her silence was ample indication of how she felt. They moved quickly, single file, down the narrow sidewalk. It didn't matter which direction they went at this point. The goal was just to get out of the transport tube as fast as possible. The droid led the way, as his photoreceptors were best able to adjust to the dim light. They saw another recessed doorway ahead as the rumbling approach of another transport began to build behind them. The door was locked, but I-5's finger blaster quickly removed that obstacle, and they hurried through it just as the freight vehicles sped by. Other than the fact that there were now no convoys thundering past, their new location was not much of an improvement. The transport tube had at least been reasonably clean and lit. Best of all, while it hadn't led back to the surface, it had remained horizontal. Now, however, they found themselves in another stairwell, only this one led down rather than up. There were no lights. The only illumination came from a phosphorescent lichen-like growth on the walls, and this light was barely enough to let them see each other in the next few steps. The ferrocrete walls wept with a slimy discharge, and there was a faint scent of decay in the air. At last they reached the bottom of the stairwell, which opened into a small chamber lit by one flickering photonic sconce. In the wall opposite the stairwell were openings to 3 branching tunnels. Signs mounted above each one supposedly gave directions, but they had been reduced to illegibility by successive layers of graffiti. "My locator was in my comlink," Darsha said. "I have no idea which way to go."
"Fortunately, I have a built-in global positioner," I-5 said. "To orient ourselves toward the Jedi Temple, we would be best served by taking that one."
He pointed to the leftmost tunnel.
"That's a good argument for taking the right-hand tunnel," Pavan muttered.
Darsha looked at him. He met her eyes for a moment and then looked away.
"I'm trying to get you back to a safe haven," she told him. "If you'd rather take your chances with our friend up there, that's fine with me. I can tell the Council about the impending blockade as easily as you can."
He turned back to look at her again.
"Hey, the Sith was probably vaporized along with your Jedi buddy, and good riddance to both of them."
Darsha felt herself go cold with anger. Without taking her gaze away from his, she said,
"I-5, what do you think the chances are that the Sith's dead?"
"Given the fact that, in our brief peripheral acquaintance with him, he has already survived several attempts on his life and killed quite a few beings as well, I wouldn't count him out until I saw his dead body. And even then, I'd want him frozen in carbonite just to make sure."
Darsha nodded.
"I agree. But you're entitled to your opinion, Pavan. Maybe it'll be safer if we all go our separate ways. After all, you seem to be the one he's looking for."
I-5 said to Pavan,
"She's right about you being the primary target. Sanctuary with the Jedi may be your only option. Are you willing to accept that?"
"Of course," Pavan replied with a scowl. "I'm not stupid, but that doesn't mean I have to be happy about the situation."
"True," Darsha said, "but you could at least try being congenial. If we're going to be stuck with each other for a while, we might as well try to make it pleasant."
She turned toward the left-hand tunnel, took a few steps toward it, then turned back to him and added,
"Anoon Bandara died saving your life. I don't want to hear any more disparaging remarks about him."
Neither Pavan nor I-5 made any reply to that as she started down the tunnel. After she had taken a few steps, they fell in behind her.
"There is no emotion, there is peace."
Well, maybe someday. After all, she wasn't a full-fledged Jedi yet, and the way things were going, it didn't look like she ever would be. But some truths you didn't need the Force to see, like the fact that one Anoon Bandara was worth a fleet of Lorne Pavans. Life on the upper levels of Coruscant was a joy to experience, because such problems as environmental pollution had been largely eradicated centuries before. But there was always a price to be paid for the benefits of technology, and while the upper levels didn't have to pay it, the lower levels did. Down here below the planet's cityscape, it was one huge pulsing malignancy of industrial waste and carcinogenic chemicals. The more sensational news programs on the Holonet were always full of stories about dangerous mutations being found in the sewers and drainage systems. Stories that, at the moment, Lorne had no problem whatsoever believing. He was sure he could hear ominous slithering sounds from either side, the slow step and drag of some murderous bipedal beast following them, the stealthy breathing of something huge and hungry about to pounce. "Stop it," he told himself sternly. "It's nothing but your imagination."
"Did you hear that?"
Asant asked. The three stopped. I-5 probed the darkness in various directions with his eye beams, which revealed nothing more than ancient moss-covered walls.
"My audio receptors are set at maximum. I hear nothing that might indicate danger. In addition, my radar detects no movement in the vicinity."
"Maybe you've got radar," Asant said, "but I've got the Force, and right now it's telling me that we're not alone."
"Impossible," Lorne said. The Jedi were always playing the Force as a whole card, using it as an excuse to justify all kinds of actions and opinions. "You think something that lives down here could have access to a radar jammer?"
He was about to enumerate several sarcastic reasons why this was a ludicrous idea when something whistled out of the darkness and struck him in the head. and he lost interest in the conversation for a while. Darsha jerked her lightsaber from its clip and activated it. She had no idea what sort of threat was impending, but whatever it was all around them. She and the droid positioned themselves back to back, with Pavan's unconscious form lying between them. I-5 had both hands up, the index fingers extended like a child pretending to point a pair of blasters. He swiveled his head slowly through 360 degrees, illuminating their surroundings. There was a branch corridor on their left and two more on their right. Nothing moved. There was no indication of where the weapon that had laid Pavan low had come from. It was a curved throwing stick. She could see it lying on the floor at her feet.
"We're too exposed here," she said in a low voice. "Pick up your friend, and let's at least get our backs against a wall."
The droid did not answer. Keeping his left finger blaster extended, he reached down with the other arm and hooked it around Pavan's waist, lifting the unconscious human as easily as Darsha might lift a small child. They began to move cautiously toward the nearest wall. The attack came from the one direction they had not expected, above. Without warning, a net of fine mesh dropped down on them. Darsha sensed it settling from overhead and slashed at it, only to have the lightsaber's blade screech and emit a shower of sparks. She realized too late that the net was charged with some kind of power field. She felt a bolt of energy slam through her, and then for the second time in as many hours, darkness engulfed her. Discipline. Discipline is all. It conquers pain. It conquers fear. Most important of all, it conquers failure. Discipline is what allowed Darth Maul to survive a 30-meter fall into a pile of rubble and debris. The discipline of his Taras Kassi fighting skills, which gave him complete control over his body, allowing him to utilize mid-air acrobatics to direct his fall. The discipline of the dark side, which let him manipulate gravity itself, slowing his descent enough to hit the ground without becoming a lifeless bag of broken bones. But even someone as skilled as Maul could not come out of such an explosion and a fall completely unscathed. After the impact, he lay, semi-conscious in the debris, remotely aware of a second explosion some distance away as the sky car blew up. He lay there, and he remembered. There is no pain where strength lies. To Darth Maul, it seemed that his master had always been there, a part of his life, implacable, indomitable, inexorable. Since before Maul learned to walk, discipline had been his guiding beacon. Darth Sidious had molded him from a weak, puling child into the ultimate warrior, sculpting his body and his mind as a seamless weapon. Maul was willing to die for him without question and without hesitation. Lord Sidious's goals were the goals of the Sith, and they would be achieved no matter what the cost. "What is done in secret has great power." One of his earliest memories was that of being taken to the Jedi Temple. Both he and Sidious had been disguised as tourists. His master's command of the dark side had been sufficient to cloak them from being sensed by their enemies, as long as they did not enter the building. That had been unlikely anyway. The Jedi Temple was not open for tourism. They had stood there for the better part of the day, Darth Sidious pointing out to him the various faces of their foes as the latter came and went. It had been thrilling to Maul to realize that he could stand in the presence of the Jedi, could listen to his master whisper to him of their ultimate downfall, without them having any inkling of the fate that ultimately awaited them. That was the great glory and hidden strength of the Sith, the fact that there were only two, master and apprentice. Their clandestine operations could take place practically under the very noses of the Jedi, and the fools would not suspect until it was too late. The day of the Jedi's downfall would be soon. Very soon. He came to his senses, realizing he was lying in a pile of trash not far from where the Jedi had engineered his own doom, and nearly Maul's as well. A Deveronian scavenger was about to appropriate his lightsaber, which lay nearby. Maul glared at the encroacher, who lost no time in making himself scarce. Maul seized his lightsaber and rose to his feet. His muscles, bones, and tendons screamed in pain, but pain meant nothing. The only important question was his mission finally complete? 100 meters down the street lay the wrecked remains of the sky car. Maul investigated it. It had been smashed beneath large chunks of ferrocrete and durasteel that would take too long to move, even with the aid of the Force. He opened his senses, trying to determine if his enemies' bodies lay beneath the rubble. What the Force told him made him clench a fist in fury. The sky car was empty. Given the kind of luck the Corellian had had so far, Maul knew he would have to see Pavan's dead body, preferably after his head had parted company with his shoulders, thanks to Maul's lightsaber, before he would feel comfortable reporting to Lord Sidious that the problem was at last resolved. He began to search the area, questing along the filaments of the dark side, seeking the route they had taken. He saw the kiosk almost immediately. Even without the Force to guide him to it, he knew this could be the only logical escape route. Unfortunately, the sky car's explosion had covered the underground entrance with debris. Maul was running out of patience. 5 meters further up the street, he spied a ventilation grid that appeared to open onto the same underground conduit as the kiosk. He lit one end of his lightsaber and jabbed it into the grid. The blade sliced easily through the metal slats. In a second, the grate had dropped down into the conduit, and Darth Maul followed it. He landed lightly. Maul found himself standing on the narrow lip of a walkway that ran along one side of the conduit. He looked about, questing with his eyes and his mind. Yes, they had escaped down here. The trail still remained. They could run, but they couldn't hide. Darth Maul resumed the hunt. Lorne blinked, then saw dim light the color of verdigris. He realized he was lying on a cold stone floor, his arms and legs bound. The light, faint and sickly though it was still too much for his headache to deal with. Must have really hung one on this time, he thought. Maybe I-5's right about those liver cells. Not that I'd ever admit it to him. But something was still wrong with this picture. He knew he could be a fairly obstreperous drunk on occasion, but he'd never reached the point of obnoxiousness where he'd had to be trussed up. Maybe he'd better open just one eye again, carefully, of course, and take another look around. Staring at him, no more than a handbreadth away, was a face unimagined in his worst nightmares. Lorne gasped and instinctively jerked backwards, trying to get away from the monstrous apparition. It moved closer to him, staring at him. No, Lorne corrected himself, not staring. You had to have eyes to stare. Just about every component of its face was repulsive in the extreme, but the eyes were unquestionably the worst. Worse than the dead bluish-white skin and the stringy, moss-like hair. Worse than the wide, lipless gash of a mouth, like a cavern entrance, filled with yellowed stalagmites and stalactites. Worse even than the skull-like nub of a nose with two vertical slits for nostrils. The eyes were definitely worse than all that, because it didn't seem to have any. From the heavy ridges at the sloping base of the forehead down to the gaunt cheekbones, there was nothing but albino skin. Behind that skin, where the orbital socket should have been, Lorne could see two egg-shaped organs moving restlessly, swiveling independently of one another. Occasionally they were occluded by darker hues, as if membranes beneath the skin were sliding over them. Lorne had dealt with a large variety of alien species in the past few years. One grew used to seeing all kinds of creatures on the streets and skywalks of Coruscant, but something was terribly, obscenely wrong about this monster's appearance. Him and the others like him, for now that Lorne's eyes had adjusted to the one light, he saw that there were at least a dozen, maybe more, hunkered down in a semicircle around him. He backed up still further, scrabbling on his heels and elbows. Not an easy task, considering that his head still felt large enough to warrant its own orbit. The creatures moved closer to him, shambling grotesquely on bent legs and knuckles. Lorne glanced around desperately, looking for I-5, feeling the beginnings of a scream welling in his throat. He saw Darsha Asant lying about 2 meters away from him on the filthy stone floor, and I-5 an equal distance on the other side. The Padawan seemed to be unconscious, but she was breathing normally, as far as he could tell. He noticed, with no great surprise, that her lightsaber no longer dangled from her utility belt. I-5 was lying with his face turned toward Lorne, and the human could see that the droid's photoreceptors were dark. His master control switch had been turned off. They were in a large chamber, the ceiling supported by groined pillars. The light, what there was of it, emanated from more of that phosphorescent lichen covering the walls. The place looked like a junkyard. Pieces of broken equipment and machinery were lying here and there. Looking closer, he saw that scattered among the technological debris were what looked like gnawed bones of various species. Lorne carefully adjusted his position, getting his legs underneath him. His head was still screaming like a Corellian banshee bird, but he tried to ignore the pain. If he could reach I-5 and flip the master switch on the back of his neck, the droid could probably make short work of these subterranean horrors. Their ears seemed to be abnormally large. No doubt they relied primarily on hearing to guide them through the darkness. One good screech from I-5's vocabulator should send them stampeding back into the shadows where they belonged. He was fairly certain he knew what they were now, although the knowledge gave him little comfort. Quite the opposite, in fact. Occasionally, since his fall from grace had landed him on the mean streets of Coruscant, he had heard rumors of devolved humanoid creatures called Cathans, lurking deep within the underground labyrinths of the planetary city. Dwelling in darkness for thousands of generations had robbed them of their eyes, so the story went. Supposedly, they retained some rudimentary working knowledge of technology, which would explain the electroshock net they had used to capture Lorne and his comrades. Supposedly, also, they were cannibals. The Cathans moved closer. "This is the way it ends," Lorne thought, feeling surprisingly little fear. What a unique career arc. To go from being a prosperous business affairs clerk in the employ of the Jedi to a fugitive about to be devoured by mutant cannibals in the bowels of Coruscant. Didn't see that one coming. The Cathans moved closer still. One reached out a pale, hirsute arm toward him. Lorne tensed. He would fight, of course. He would not be led like a nerf to the slaughter. He could at least do that much. "I'm sorry, Jax," he thought, as they closed in on him. Obi-Wan Kenobi activated the descent repulsor array and dropped out of the airstream traffic flow, his skycar moving in a tight spiral down toward the blanket of mist that marked the inversion layer. It was just before sunset, and the cerise light faded fast as he descended. He glanced at the instrument panel, reassuring himself that he was homing in on the coordinates for the safe house in the Crimson Corridor. Descending through the cloud layer was almost like making a hyperspace jump to some decrepit outlying planet. Obi-Wan had known that slums like this existed here and there on Coruscant's surface, of course. He just hadn't realized that one lay this close to the Jedi Temple, less than 10 kilometers away. Once through the mist, The sky car's head and ground lights activated, and he could see fairly clearly. The vehicle came to a hovering stop a few centimeters from the cracked surface of the street. The area was relatively deserted, save for a dozen or so mendicants of various species who fled as his sky car touched down. That was odd, Obi-Wan thought. One would expect them to crowd around, begging instead. Perhaps it had to do with the fact that this was raptor territory after dark. He looked around and saw Darsha's skyhopper parked not far away, in the shadow of a building. He deactivated the safety field and vaulted over the sky car's edge. When Master Qui-Gon had told Obi-Wan that Darsha Asant was missing, the Padawan had volunteered to search for her before his mentor could tell him to. He and Darsha were not close friends, but she had been in several of his classes, and he had been quite impressed with the way she had excelled in her studies. They had even shared a mission once. Obi-Wan thought that Darsha had the makings of a fine Jedi Knight in her. And it wouldn't take much coaxing to get him to admit that she was pleasant to look at as well. Even if she had been someone he couldn't stand to be around, he would have accepted without question the assignment to search for her. It was, after all, his duty. But Darsha, he felt, was special even among the Jedi. He hoped she had not come into harm's way. Now, however, looking at her skyhopper, he found that hope fading fast, for the craft had been gutted. Something flickered at the edge of his vision. Obi-Wan froze, then slowly turned to look. He saw nothing threatening in the vespertine shadows. Nevertheless, there had definitely been movement, stealthy, furtive movement. He had been thoroughly briefed on the dangers of street gangs and predators, both human and non-human, in the Crimson Corridor. It did not take an overactive imagination to assume that one of these threats might be lurking nearby, ready to strike. If there was a whole gang of footpads sizing him up, he would be hard put to defend himself even with a lightsaber. Fortunately, the lightsaber was not the only defense at his disposal. Obi-Wan Kenobi reached out for the Force. It was there for him, as it always was. He let his awareness expand outward along its invisible corrugations, a psychic radar that searched and probed the darkness. If danger existed, the Force would find it. His mind touched that of another, a will that felt weak and serpentine, more used to striking furtively from the shadows than in direct confrontation. A human mind. Before the lurker was fully aware that he was being probed, Obi-Wan seized his will. The Force, Master Qui-Gon had told him more than once, can have a strong influence on the weak-minded. Though Obi-Wan was by no means anywhere near as accomplished a practitioner as his tutor, it didn't take much more than the skill of a novice to influence a mind as weak as this one. "Come here," he said, his tone quiet and authoritative. From out of the dusk emerged a young human male, probably around 16 or 17 standard years old, Obi-Wan estimated. He was wearing mostly rags and leather, topped by a 10-centimeter-high thatch of green hair held in place by an electrostatic field. The Padawan could feel the sullen guilt and fear in the other's mind, the fear that his captor somehow knew that he and his gang had assaulted the other Jedi. "Where is she?" Obi-Wan asked.
I don't know.
Yes, you do. The Jedi Padawan who owned this skyhopper. Tell me quickly, or..." Obi-Wan let his hand drop to rest suggestively on the lightsaber hilt hanging at his belt. He wouldn't go so far as to actually use it, but even a veiled threat could work wonders. He could feel Greenhair's fear and hatred like an acid in his brain. It was difficult to keep his composure.
"All right. We messed with her a little. But we took the hint when she chopped off Nig's hand, you know? I mean, she wanted the ship so bad she could have it, right?"
"Where did she go?" Greenhair shook his head and shrugged. Obi-Wan listened to the Force and knew he was telling the truth. "Was there a Fondorian male with her?"
"Him?" Greenhair grinned crookedly. "The Hawkbats got him. What was left, the street trash dragged off."
Obi-Wan felt despair pushing in on him. It appeared that Darsha's mission had been a total failure that might very well have culminated in her death.
"There was some more Jedi," Greenhair said abruptly. "I didn't see it, but I heard about it."
"Heard about what?"
"Some of my blood saw somebody on a speeder bike chasing another in a sky car. He caught up with him, and there was this big brawl. The speeder blew up, and the car crashed over on Barsoom Boulevard. Big blow-up. That's why I heard."
Obi-Wan frowned in puzzlement. The Jedi Greenhair spoke of could only be Darsha and her mentor, Anoon Bandara. He questioned Greenhair more thoroughly, making sure he would be able to find the crash site, then released him from thrall. The boy lost no time in making himself scarce. Obi-Wan got back in his sky car and headed for the location, more puzzled than ever. Even under careful questioning and mind-probing, Greenhair had stuck to his story. Two robed and cowled figures had been seen first in a high-speed pursuit and subsequently on a docking ledge, battling each other with all the ferocity of a couple of Tyrusian manglers. The battle had culminated in two big explosions, as both the speeder bike and the sky car had blown up. Obi-Wan shook his head as he piloted the sky car down the dark and narrow streets. Speculation was fruitless at this point. With any luck, all would be made clear when he reached the crash site. Very little had been disturbed since the crash of the sky car. In this part of town, it might be months before a droid cleanup crew was assigned to deal with the wreckage. But few of Obi-Wan's questions were answered by investigating the torn and twisted hulk of the sky car, or the nearby pile of debris that was once a docking ledge. So much rubble was piled on Master Bandara's vehicle that Obi-Wan couldn't even tell if bodies were still in it or not. The Force did not seem to indicate that a Jedi had died here, but it had been several hours since the occurrence, and what perturbation remained in the energy field was subtle and hard to read. Possibly Master Qui-Gon Jinn could read it, but Obi-Wan was not that skilled yet. Still, he sensed something disturbing here. The sense of a powerful evil, a corruption. Obi-Wan glanced about him nervously. The street was mostly deserted and quiet, but it wasn't a peaceful silence. Instead, it bore a feeling of trepidation, of lurking danger. Obi-Wan shook his head, attempting to banish the sudden surge of uneasiness. There is no emotion. There is peace. Giving in to paranoia would not further his mission. He had to operate from the assumption that either Darsha or Master Bandara, or both, were still alive. Based on that assumption, he had to find an eyewitness to the battle who could give him a better account of what had happened. Facts were what he needed, not speculation and hearsay. There is no ignorance, there is knowledge. He knew this was true. Nevertheless, it was hard to quell the anxiety he felt as he started toward a nearby tavern to ask some questions of the locals. 2 hours later, Obi-Wan was more baffled than ever. He had found few people who were willing to talk with him without being prodded by the Force, and what little he had learned was confusing and contradictory. One thing was for certain. A lot had been happening in this neighborhood recently, even by the rough-and-tumble standards of the Crimson Corridor. He had found no one who would admit to being an eyewitness to the battle, but several had seen the high-speed chase between the sky car and the speeder bike. Some had said there were Jedi involved, some said one or none. Some swore a droid was piloting the sky car. Some were certain a Jedi had been riding the speeder, others were not. He had also learned that a black-clad figure, possibly, according to one, the figure who had been on the speeder bike, had been somehow implicated in yet another explosion, this one in a block of cubicles a few streets away. Several people had been killed in that blast, including a human bounty hunter. There had also been a fracas at a nightclub owned by a local Black Sun Vigo, one Yanth the Hutt, in which a cowled character had been somehow implicated. None of this seemed to make any kind of sense. He had spoken to one witness who seemed certain that the two Jedi in the sky car had been a Twi'lek male and a human female. That would be Anoon Bandara and Darsha, Obi-Wan surmised. But he still had no clue as to whether they had survived the explosions. His informants said they had been riding with a human male and a droid. After some consideration, Obi-Wan decided his best bet would be to investigate the nightclub. If Yanth, the owner, was a member of Black Sun, he might know more about all this than the street rabble. "I've got a bad feeling about this," he murmured to himself as he headed for the nightclub. As from a far distance, Darsha heard the sounds of a struggle. It seemed to rise and fall, the sounds breaking over her like oceanic waves as her mind struggled to find its way back to consciousness. She wished dimly that whatever was going on would stop, so that she could slip back down into the depths of the black well out of which she was reluctantly rising. And suddenly, in a rush of returning wakefulness, Darsha remembered what had happened. The attack by unseen foes in the tunnels, the electroshock net that had trapped them. She had been knocked out by the net's power field. Darsha opened her eyes and managed to raise her head enough to see what was going on, even though doing so sent a stab of pain like a blaster bolt through her skull. What she saw kicked her adrenal glands into overdrive. Pavan was struggling with several creatures, hard to tell in the dim light exactly what they were other than bipedal and definitely subhuman. He had apparently managed to knock one of them unconscious. The limp form lay on the mossy stone floor next to the droid, who seemed to be out of commission as well. Darsha pushed herself up to a kneeling position. The movement attracted the attention of several of the creatures who were circling Pavan, looking for an opening. They turned and shambled toward her, their snarling mouths stretched wide. She saw the undulating skin that covered their eye sockets, and the horror of the sight caused her heart to stutter. Darsha gathered the force to her. Still on her knees, she thrust out both arms, fingers splayed wide, hurling twin waves of invisible power toward them. The unexpected surges struck them, causing them to stagger back. They howled in mingled fear and anger. Darsha took advantage of the momentary respite to stagger to her feet. She reached instinctively for her lightsaber and wasn't really surprised to find it missing from its belt. She had no time to look for it, because now several more of the subhumans were lumbering her way. Pavan, who had two of them hanging on each arm, saw she was awake. "Kathans!" he shouted to her. "They're cannibals!" His words sent a chill of fear and repugnance down Darsha's spine. Like most people who live on Coruscant, she had heard the legends of the sightless subhumans, but had never considered them based in reality. Fear gave her new strength and focus, and once again she drove them back by throwing force waves at them. But they were stronger than they looked, and extremely tenacious. Though battered off their feet by her power, they picked themselves up and came back for more, moaning and howling. Pavan was doing worse than she was, having only his fists and feet to fight with. The Kathans were dragging him toward one of the darker recesses of the chamber. "I-5's been deactivated," he called to her. "He can help us."
"Yes, of course,"
Darsha thought. She'd had first-hand experience of how strong the droid was when he'd carried both her and Pavan to safety after the Skycar's crash. She looked at I-5 and could just see in the dim light that the master switch on the back of his head was in the off position. Could she reactivate him? She wasn't sure. There was no way she could reach him physically, and she wasn't at all confident in her control of the Force, particularly under these circumstances. It was one thing to use it like a bludgeon against an enemy, but quite another to flip a small switch several meters away. She pushed the doubts away. She had to do it, or she and Pavan were quite literally dead meat. She focused her mind on the droid, felt the tenuous, intangible connection between her thoughts and the cool metal of the control switch. She pushed against it with her mind, feeling the resistance. A Kathan grabbed her from behind. Dasha bit back on a cry of shock and surprise. She felt her attenuated mental grip on the tiny nub of Durasteel almost slip free, and with all the power of her will, she thrust the force tendril against it. Then the Kathan yanked her backwards, and she felt its clammy fingers, like the hands of a corpse, reach up and close about her neck. A shrill screech, unlike anything she had ever heard before, suddenly filled the air. It was more than just unpleasant. It was actively painful. It drilled into both ears and expanded in the center of Darsha's head like something alive and voracious. The Kathan released her, and she staggered forward, clapping her hands over her ears. But it was obvious that the stridency was causing the Kathans far more pain than she was feeling. Their shrieks and moans of agony were barely audible above the continuing screech, which Dasha now realized was coming from I-5. The reactivated droid was standing. He moved quickly, pushing through the dazed group of subhumans toward Lorn Pavan, while the ear-splitting sound continued to emanate from his vocabulator. The Kathans who had been dragging Pavan away were writhing in pain like their comrades, leaving him free. Dasha followed in the droid's wake. I-5 grabbed Pavan and headed for the dark aperture of a tunnel in the chamber's far wall. No matter where it led, it had to be someplace better than where they were now. But the chances of their reaching it were not looking good. Though obviously still in pain, the Kathans were starting to rally, no doubt motivated by the sight of their dinner making an escape. Dasha hurled more invisible blows to either side, clearing a path for the three of them, but a large group was gathering ahead to block their escape. Dasha looked about desperately for something to use as a weapon, and saw her lightsaber lying perhaps 5 meters away on a mound of mingled offal and techno-trash. With a gasp of surprise and gratitude, she reached out for it with her hand and her mind. The device flew from its position across the intervening space and smacked into her hand. She thumbed the activator button and heard the satisfying thrum as the yellow blade boiled out to its full length. She gripped the weapon in both hands, weaving it in a figure-eight defensive pattern. Against the combined threats of her lightsaber and the droid's howl, the subhumans had no choice but to fall back. The three entered the tunnel at a dead run, I-5 in the lead, and Dasha bringing up the rear. Their former captors' enraged cries followed them, but that was all. The phosphorescent lichen that covered the chamber's walls continued only a short way into the underground passage and then died out. I-5 illuminated his photoreceptors, revealing a brick-lined tunnel barely high enough for Lorne to stand upright. I-5 shut off the screeching sound once they were out of sight of the Kathan's chamber. They dropped from a run to a fast walk. Dasha had to hustle to keep up with the long-legged strides of the other two, and each time her boots contacted the hard pavestones, she felt a new spear of pain go through her head. She wished devoutly that one of the Force's attributes was an ability to cure headaches. As if reading her mind, the droid began making another sound, a low trilling that was as unlike the discordant noise of before as it was possible to be. It seemed to somehow penetrate her bones and muscles, indeed her very cells, and subtly vibrate them, flushing away the toxins and pains that had filled them. After a few minutes, the sound ceased, leaving her feeling, if not in top shape, at least markedly better. After walking for another few minutes, I-5 stopped. Pavan and Dasha stopped as well, the latter deactivating her lightsaber as she did so.
"My sensors indicate no one is following us," the droid said.
"Let's keep moving anyway," Pavan replied. "You were wrong before, remember?"
"Don't be so hard on him," Dasha said. "After all, he just saved our lives again." "Much as I crave validation, I feel constrained to point out that you saved us this time," said I-5. "I couldn't have done anything if you hadn't reactivated me."
Though the droid was speaking to Dasha, he was looking at Lorne Pavan. Pavan hesitated a moment, scowling. Then he looked at Dasha and said, "He's right. Thanks." It obviously had taken a herd of wild banthas to drag the words out of him. Why did he hate Jedi so much? Dasha wondered. Aloud, she said, "No problem. You saved my life back in the sky car. Now we're even." Pavan gave her a look that seemed equal parts gratitude and resentment. He said to Y-5, "Let's find the fastest route back to the surface. Even the raptors look friendly compared to what lives down here." The droid nodded and started walking again. The two humans followed. "I'm surprised the Kathans gave up so easily," Pavan said abruptly to the droid. "They didn't even follow us into this tunnel."
"I've been wondering about that as well," I-5 said. "Two possibilities come to mind, neither of them particularly pleasant to contemplate. The first is that they may be planning another trap of some sort."
"That's what I was thinking," Pavan replied. "What's your second scenario?"
"That there may be something up ahead that even the Kathans fear."
Darth Maul followed his instincts. They led him a short distance along the transit tube and down a stairwell, and from there into a dark tunnel. He moved swiftly but cautiously. He knew that this deep in the guts of the planet there lived creatures that even a Sith Lord would have a hard time dealing with. But they would not keep him from overtaking his quarry and completing his mission. He would kill Pavan first, for two reasons. Because he was the primary target, of course, but also because Maul would then be free to take his time killing the Jedi. He did not anticipate her putting up much of a fight. His impression was that she had been naught but an apprentice to the Twi'lek he had killed, and thus not much of a potential opponent. But she was still a Jedi, and he could toy with her for a bit before delivering the fatal blow. He felt he deserved some entertainment as partial recompense for all the trouble they had put him to. As Lorne followed I-5 through the dark tunnel, he considered various possible solutions to his situation. Assuming that they made it back above ground and were able to return to the civilized levels of society, what should his next move be? He knew that the Padawan planned on taking him straight to the Jedi Temple so that he could share his information with Mace Windu and the other council members, but that event was not anywhere near the top of Lorne's list of desires. Certainly the Jedi would be best at protecting him from the Sith, assuming their tracker had not been killed in the explosion, but as far as he was concerned, it would be a solution almost as bad as the problem. To be a resource held and used by the Jedi? It was a sickening thought, one that awoke far too many memories Lorne had worked hard to put away. So instead of giving in to the feelings that threatened to overwhelm him, he considered his other obvious option. Run. The key question was how to get on board a ship that could take him and I-5 far enough away to avoid being tracked by both the Sith and the Jedi. And then he remembered. Tuden Sahl. A few months past, he'd given the owner of a successful chain of restaurants a tidbit of data that had helped the Sakian keep his liquor license. At the time, Lorne had been flush and had charged only a few drinks. Well, more than a few. But Sahl had promised him a favor if the day ever came that he needed one. As far as Lorne was concerned, that day was here. Tuden Sahl was known to have strong contacts with several smuggling organizations, including Black Sun. He would know how to get them off Coruscant. Lorne felt revitalized by the possibility. This was a good plan, if he could just stay alive long enough to make it happen. Ahead of him, the droid slowed down. There was a change that Lorne could feel in the air. The echoes of their footsteps seemed to be hollower, more distant. I-5 confirmed it.
"For those of you who are interested, the cavern we have just entered is roughly 700 standard meters wide, 200 meters across, and festooned with stalactites starting 40 or 50 meters above our heads. The ledge we are on, unfortunately, ends within 7 meters, culminating in a drop that is..."
The droid paused.
"Currently not measurable with my modest sensory capabilities."
Dasha heard Lorne Pavan release a long-suffering sigh. "Let me guess," he said. We have to jump across.
Not unless you've suddenly gained greater levitation powers than our Sith friend, the droid replied.
Darsha reached out with the Force. She sensed nothing other than the usual